Okay. Today we're interviewing Jonathan Wood from White Box Advisors. Participating in the phone call is Tony Ingolia, Desi Dunker, and Gary Cohen and Landon Strobel. This is August 11th, 2010. Thank you. Jonathan, we really want to thank you for doing this on the record and being part of the oral history. And this will become part of our archives. So we really appreciate you participating in this, and we think it's a great service.
I'm happy to do it.
Okay. Why don't we start off, just give us a brief background on your fund and its strategies, what hedge fund space you play in.
Yeah, I'm going to back up just a little bit more, if you don't mind, just in terms of my background in the industry, and then I can kind of launch into White Box Advisors and what we've been up to for the last 10 years.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I came into the industry back in 1991, joined a firm locally here in Minneapolis, was one of the first groups that broke away from Cargill to form what ended up being kind of multiple hedge funds playing in international markets.
Cargill.
I worked with them.
I was going to just interrupt so that the my colleagues know. Cargill, in a sense, while it's a commodities firm, also has a very large hedging and market operations as well, and you know, almost as a hedge fund by itself. I don't know if my colleagues knew that.
That is correct. They were substantially, you know, they had a division back in the late 80s, and I'm sure prior to that, but they called it the Financial Markets Division. And it was trading proprietary money for the firm as well as some of the family money. And the senior individual for the group left basically because he wanted to trade other folks' money alongside in similar strategies. Thought there was a great opportunity, and the family was not interested in doing that. In any event, he left in 89. I joined them in 91. I was with them for about 9 years. Hit more or less the proverbial glass ceiling and started to explore other opportunities. I bumped into Andy in White Box basically through a headhunter. Andy was looking to start a new firm. This would have been in 2000. Doing what he was calling kind of single focus funds at the time, which is kind of defining a strategy and then creating offering documents that we felt suited the strategy and putting the onus kind of back on the investor and making the determination in terms of, you know, they want long short equity exposure, credit exposure, convertible exposure, so on and so forth. And so I joined him about 6 months after he got going and pretty much assumed the role of CFO, and it's kind of evolved into a CFO, COO role where I'm responsible for the business operations and both kind of street relationships, if you will, as well as investor relationships, and oversee kind of all aspects of the business other than trading. So there's a brief background. The first product that we started with was a statistical fund back in 2000. It was, you know, really a long short equity fund that was a pairs-based short-term mean reversion strategy. It worked very well in the early years prior to decimalization. It became a strategy that was more difficult to run following that and kind of the ensuing VWAP processing or trading systems that became more prevalent almost on workstations as opposed to mainframe computers.
And John, sorry, really quickly, for the long short equity fund, were you trading any particular industry in particular, or were you just looking for general equity opportunities?
It really was, in some ways, a strategy that identified U.S. large cap companies that, historically speaking, traded within a certain spread, and typically because of noise or other unusual situations, they diverge. One would be, for example, say a trust that was given a holding that is under mandate required to divest. It would cause a temporary dislocation in kind of the historical spread. Others, you'd find financial institutions that make a call, for example, on integrated oil But when they do that, they substantially invest in one or two of the companies. When they change their call and look to exit, it tends to create, again, kind of an abnormal dislocation in the spread of one integrated oil company with another.
Okay, so you go long short based on a strategy of temporary market dislocation and kind of capitalize on the mean reversion, but you weren't looking.
Mean reversion, right?
You weren't looking to invest in the sector in particular.
No, it was the common theme was that they were commodity-like or commodity-based companies, so they had little influence on the input and the output as it related to the value of the company. Oil is a great example. And we would basically screen for news to when the spreads diverge to get comfortable that it wasn't being caused by a news event and would basically then develop conviction around it being caused by what we would call order flow noise.
Okay, so just to be clear, the shares traded were U.S. large-cap commodity-based companies?
Correct.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to diverge there.
Not at all. The next strategy we launched in 2001 was a convertible strategy, U.S. converts. Nothing kind of unusual in our approach. We tend to focus more on the tails in terms of convertibles beyond what we call beyond busted names and synthetic put-like names deep in the money. That strategy is probably one that we're best known for, one that we continue in today, and it's put up a very solid track record for its 10-year history. The last, what I would call kind of the last core strategy that we launched was in 2002, and that was a credit fund. We took somewhat of a convertible approach to the credit space. We identified high-yielding credits that we'd hedge out equity, use equity and options to hedge out the default risk. As best we could assess it, and in the meantime collect very strong, convincing, positive carry on those positions and reduce the risk. That strategy, again, it continues today. It ebbs and flows within the credit space, kind of where the opportunities are. We also chose at that time to launch what became known as our multi-strategy fund, and in many ways was an acknowledgement that there's many investors that want to make, or want the general partner, I should say, want the general partner to make the allocation decision on their behalf as to whether they're in equities, convertibles, or credit, or at what ratios. And those really have been kind of the cornerstone of the firm. We've done some other one-off opportunities, some that did not kind of evolve into strategies the way we anticipated. We did a hedge, what we call a hedge hydrocarbon fund in 2005 that was meant to be around the hydrocarbon complex. Too much volatility. We didn't like the way it performed. We chose to wind that down. We also launched a what we call diversified convertible fund, which was meant to be more of an asset class kind of return strategy of U.S. convertibles done at beta prices, I guess I would say. There was no incentive fee associated with that fund. The management fee scaled down depending on the size of the investment from 1.5% to 1%. It's never gotten traction the way that we had hoped it would. It probably peaked at $280 million in its life, and currently it runs 50, and probably has been, for the majority of that time in that 50 to 75 million range. The last platform of strategies, I guess I would call it, are the White Box Special Opportunities Funds. Those were niche-focused products with a term, typically 3 years, that were meant to focus on specific opportunities that we identified, have a better asset liability matching with the underlying investments, and create a way for our investors to get direct exposure to what we thought were unique opportunities. The first one we launched was in April of 2007, and that was around RMBS. It was shorting subprime in single name mortgage pools. The next one we did was a private convertible-focused fund. That one, I think, because of when it was launched, which was kind of late 07, really hasn't gotten a lot of traction and probably won't. It's remained between 25 and 30 million. The third series in the fund complex was one we call Special Opportunities Series D as in David. That was a dislocated convert fund that was launched in November of 2008. Special Opportunities A was unwound at the end of March of the current year. The dislocated convert fund D was wound down at the end of 2009, and that capital was returned to investors in January of this year. Special Opportunity B does still continue, but you know, it's likely not going to attract any more capital, and it's more likely that it's going to see the existing investments kind of through fruition and then return capital.
Okay. Thanks for that background.
That's kind of a brief history on the firm and the products.
Do we know the AUM?
If you wouldn't mind, Jonathan, can you specify your AUM?
Our AUM, when we started, you know, we had roughly $10 million of partner capital. We peaked in the summer of 08 at about $4.8 billion. We probably finished 08 at about $3.2 billion. We then went through a restructuring, wound down investments in liquidating funds, returned capital of about $1.2 billion in 2009, ended 2009 at about $3.2 billion, mostly through organic growth. And where we are today is about $2.5 billion. Some of that, again, kind of on the back of our decision to wind down and return capital in special opportunities products. That probably accounted for about $500 million of the AUM change between December 31 and now. And then we've gone through the last two quarters of redemption cycles with about $130 million returned each quarter.
Okay. Thanks for that background. Can you give us, obviously this question could be 2 hours long, but hopefully we can just keep it brief. Can you just give us a little narrative of the crisis from your perspective, noting first indications, tipping points, or any panics if they're applicable?
Sure. And if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind giving you, from my perspective, you know, a little history on the industry in terms of, you know, dealing with counterparties over the last 20 years and what changed as well.
Sure, that would be great. And that's
because I do think it's relevant.
That's what we're here for. So
I came up in I came up in this industry kind of like you do in a family business. I was doing accounting and I did, you know, treasury functions, and so I've seen a lot of different aspects of it, but. Back, you know, call it almost 20 years ago, when Reg T was, you know, the way most hedge funds traded, they kept their assets onshore. You were constrained by Reg T in terms of how much leverage you could use. To my recollection, UBS and Morgan Stanley at that time came up with a creative way of doing arranged or enhanced financing. And in doing that, they essentially created legal structures to move your custody positions from being onshore to being offshore, and then moved you to a risk, it shouldn't say a rules-based margining system, that they could basically apply house risk rules in terms of how much they wanted to lend against your positions. At that time, you know, certain corporate bonds and by all means bank debt was not lent against, wouldn't even come close. It was 100% requirements. And it was kind of the more liquid kinds of things, but you could get more leverage on your overall portfolio. And that's kind of the world we lived in for many years. As the industry kind of exploded, which I would say is kind of the 2000 to 2007 time frame, not too dissimilar from the aggressive lending that we saw in the residential real estate markets, institutions became much more aggressive in what they were willing to lend against. And bank debt that you used to never be able to borrow against if you were willing to pool, you know, probably at a minimum 20 names into a total return swap and put the positions in the name of the institution, you know, at extremes, you were able to get 4 to 5 times leverage on something that used to get nothing. Along with that was the financing side of the business. Financing, you know, probably in the, call it early 90s, even through the 98 crisis, was about, you know, what we would say, you know, 125 basis points through the middle in terms of what it cost us to do business. And again, at the extremes, when you saw 07, tremendous competition, the financing got pressed down to, you know, 30 basis points at an extreme. I think if you were a larger firm like ourselves, it was pretty common to see 35 to 40 basis points on the more easy to borrow names. Other aspect, I would say, of the business that kind of evolved over 20 years was managers like ourselves taking a more legal negotiating standpoint when it came to our agreements that we did with these institutions, be it the prime brokerage agreement or the ISDA agreement. Way back when you got or wanted to start a relationship with a large institution, you pretty much got the documents from them and you signed them and you gave them back. I'm not so sure that everyone even read them, quite candidly. Two, you know, getting much more involved in negotiating whether or not instruments were able to be rehypothecated, getting more creative in terms of, and I think some of this on the back of 98, I knew some funds, I knew some guys, you know, where within the legal guidelines, if you will, of the agreements, institutions were able to take over your positions and did so, gave you the price, they were the calc agent on what they were worth, and that was kind of the end of the day and the end of your business. And many managers became much more aggressive in their negotiations on who was the calculating agent on their securities, what were the arbitration language that would be permitted, and if there would be a committed facility, an arranged account, you know, whatever you want to call the terminology that got thrown out, but essentially a period of time for you to react, and they were somewhat at a standstill. And again, I would say all of those things, and again, depending somewhat on the size of your institution or your funds, you had ability to negotiate those things and create a more secure, more attractive, you know, relationship for your underlying investors. So I got a little bit off on a narrative there, but I think it's somewhat relevant to, you know, the evolution of the industry. Now, going back to, you know, why, and again, this may be somewhat my view, but I believe the government and the regulatory bodies became somewhat concerned by the number and value of assets that were being held offshore. I sensed this, I would say, in mid-07. Some of the large institutions that we did business with began to talk to us about a new margining system. They referred to it as PMI, portfolio margining something. It was going to be a new system that was not rules-based but risk-based. It was going to be used for U.S. holdings. They wanted to move positions from being offshore in arranged enhanced accounts back onshore and then roll you into the new PMI system, telling us that, you know, it was more risk-based, it would be better. And as that evolved, probably from early 07 into, you know, call it first quarter of 08, you'd have periodic calls with these institutions, and they would kind of keep wanting to nudge you that direction, but there was no kind of definitive, we're going to move you, here's the cutover date, and you're going to need to put up more margin. But that was going on in the background. Two institutions that we happened to be doing business with at the time, I know were beta testing that product, had brought some clients on and were in the process of trying to bring more clients on that system.
Hey, Jonathan, can I cut you off really quickly just to peer into that a little bit more, this PMI
sure.
system? What was what were the incentives from your perspective in terms of why would you want to switch from to PMI from the previous systems and with your prime brokers, and why would you not want to switch?
I think the one thing that was always difficult, again, trying to kind of call it that 90 till that, you know, early 90s until then, was you were dealing with rules-based systems that couldn't understand and always associate securities to recognize the offsets and apply the appropriate margin. What you would typically find, as an example, is you know, if you had a book that convertibles is always a great example because they're very mathematical. Everyone could understand, you know, what the hedge was, what the requirements were relative to you know, the unhedged portion, how much was going to be required in addition for the premium, and then you would hit other kinds of investments where those rules really didn't work. Cap structure is probably, you know, a reasonable type of style trade that for many years, you know, they didn't have rules-based systems that really worked to apply or recognize the risk associated with the trade and apply the right requirements. So what you would find is you would talk to the risk groups, you'd help them understand the trade, and what they would do is they would tweak the rules-based system. So if they used to require, say, 25% of premium on your convertibles, they would say, well, we'll bring it down to 20%, and that will kind of acknowledge that there's less risk in this other part of the portfolio that we can't apply rules towards, and on a portfolio basis, we're comfortable that we've got the right amount of collateral. Moving to, you know, what everyone hoped was a risk-based system was going to allow for better matching of securities and the inherent risks in the trade, you know, so that you were getting kind of the appropriate release for the appropriate amount of risk. So I don't know that any of us were excited about going to the new system. I think we were intrigued. And again, especially options was an area that if you traded options, those could not move over to the enhanced arranged platform.
Okay.
And if you used options as part of your hedge, there was a real mismatch in the risk in terms of the collateral being required. If you move the other assets back onshore, one of the benefits would be that they could use the options, again, in a risk system to make that match and reduce the amount of overall collateral required for that particular trade.
And just to be clear, when you say risk-based, do you mean based on their models, your prime broker's models, or based on your models, or is there some kind of collaboration?
Oh, no, it's never our models.
Okay, just want to make that clear.
It is their models, and part of the, you know, part of the challenge in the crisis, you know, kind of continuing with this evolution was, you know, we were getting tapped on the shoulder saying we'd like to do this and it'll be a better system, to getting a phone call that basically said, we need to move you to the system in 2 weeks. And that rolls forward to like an October 08 discussion. We're moving you onto the new system.
Okay.
The institutions that were in beta testing had a leg up. They had a kind of dual margining system. They had the old system and the new system. They could tweak this new PMI system to be whatever they needed it to be, and apply it and then increase the requirements. One of the things I think, you know, the biggest challenge for a lot of managers was understanding what was going into their model because it wasn't simple. There were concentration overlays, you know, there were a bunch of stress test overlays, things that they were, you know, not really forthcoming in how it's calculated, other than there was going to be this, you know, kind of overlay of requirements that is kind of a portfolio risk-based.
So just prying into that a little further, I mean, how much transparency was there in terms of the models at the prime brokerage firms in margining and pricing? I mean, was there any kind of transparency at all, or was it just them saying, you know, this is based on our model, you know, this is how much you can margin?
I would say it was pretty limited. There was more of a verbal discussion as opposed to demonstration.
Okay.
You know, there's, you know, and some of it you could, you know, they could speak specifically to, but to the extent that they're using stress testing, it was, you know, nearly impossible for most managers to substantiate what that number was and how it was derived. Concentration issues were easy. All of us could say, you know, and they went from, as an example, and I couldn't tell you if this existed in the real world, but if there were an institution that issued, or a company, excuse me, issued corporate bonds, convertible bonds, preferred equities, you know, whatever number of instruments you can come up with, if all of those were under one company, Ford, GM, pick one, then there was a new overlay that said, you know, we are concerned about how much exposure you have to that particular company. And those were ones you could see. We didn't, you know, whether we agreed with the approach or didn't really matter, but we could understand it.
So what about, going in that example, what about supposedly perfectly hedged trades? So purchasing the convertibles and shorting the equity, was that, would based on your models, would you get some credit for that? Would their models incorporate kind of, you know, trades that you saw as perfectly hedged? Or was it really arbitrary?
Absolutely. Again, kind of in an extreme example, but say a company had three convertible instruments outstanding. And we look at those investments kind of from a bottoms-up, trade-by-trade basis. We look at convertible A that's got 5 years to maturity, you know, whatever the premium, the coupon, parity, all of those things taken into consideration. We come up with what we think is the appropriate hedge, and they may agree with us on that specific instrument and what we've hedged it with and how it's hedged and what the risks are.
Okay.
Now, if we agree on each of those individually, what the new system would do would say, fine, however, all three of those are exposed to Ford credit, and we do agree with you on them individually. However, we want this additional coverage from a collateral standpoint because they're all Ford.
Okay, that makes sense.
So it was just, you know, changing the process a bit. So as I was kind of saying, there was discussions about that that really carried on from probably late 07 into early 08. That we want to move you to the new system. The one thing that was true of the two institutions that were beta testing wanting to move us to this, when we asked, or I did, about, well, what is the change in my requirements? What's the difference going to be for me? How much more do I need to put up? I never had an answer. They never came back to me telling me how much it would be, and what they would tell us is it's not going to be that meaningful.
Okay.
Now, roll the clock forward when the crisis hits after Lehman and everything starts getting kind of discombobulated. Convertibles are the most difficult instrument on the street to finance. There is no tri-party repo really available. They come to us saying, we're going to need to implement this. Here's how much your collateral, additional collateral is going to be. And by the way, and kind of in the same vein, as you talked about these new margining systems, there was undertones of it getting more expensive to finance your business. We're probably going to need to move you up or charge you more. All of it hit like a lead balloon in mid-October. I got one phone call, the first phone call from one institution, saying exactly like I just said to you, we're going to have to move you to the system. Here's what the requirements are going to be. You're going to get spreadsheets shortly or reports reflecting this. You know, we need to move you on to the system in the next couple of weeks. Your financing is going to go from 30 or 40 basis points through the middle to 250 basis points. And this is all going to happen in the next couple of weeks. That was the one and only phone call that I had, because I went and met with the rest of the partners. I got on a plane and I flew to New York the next day, and I met with all the other institutions that we were doing business with, and at the time it was five. And, you know, basically said, you know, this is what one institution's telling me. I suspect that they're doing this. You're either thinking of doing it or in the process of doing this. I need to get a handle on our business. I need to know how much collateral all of you are going to require, number one. Number two, I want to be sure that you understand the entire portfolio and what it is at risk. So I became much more transparent to all these institutions in showing them the entire portfolio, so that they could be more comfortable with us as a firm. All of them indicated that they're, you know, going to move. They're all going to go to, you know, ballpark it, say, two times the requirements that they had been at. So if I needed to put up $100 million, I now need to put up $200 million. They all wanted to do it in 2 weeks. They all wanted to move you in 2 weeks to the new financing levels, which made it extremely difficult to do business, if at all, at 250. And, you know, came back, met with the partners, told them, you know, kind of what my conversation entailed, what was likely to occur, and we then at that point made a decision that the right thing to do for our investors was to suspend redemptions. Now, our funds had offered monthly liquidity with 30 days notice, had always met those requirements with any requests, for a number of years, you know, basically 2000 till 2008. The one thing that we did not do in most of our strategies is have any other liquidity constraint. So we did not have gates, we did not have, you know, kind of any other tool in the toolbox other than to suspend redemptions, which was within the agreement. It obviously didn't make any friends with our investors. I think we were earlier than most to make that decision. We did not have a substantial amount of redemptions that were supposed to be paid on November 1st. As a percentage of overall assets of the firm, I think it would have been about 10%. It varied a little bit by product, but that is kind of the firm number. We notified investors, you know, almost immediately after making the decision as partners, told them that, you know, we would be working on a restructuring plan, would present that to them as quickly as we could, and then in the meantime, we tried to communicate as frequently as we could with our investors through our kind of email distribution list that we frequently report to investors on a weekly basis, our estimated returns on a monthly basis, kind of the fund performance and some details about that, as well as kind of a narrative letter from our founding partner.
Did you guys side pocket any investments?
We did. What we did is we went and met as partners and said, you know, I think the first decision for us is, okay, we know there's going to be a number of investors who want their money back. And we know that there will be some investors who will stay with us. We spent our time focused on, first, what does the fund terms need to look like for those investors that choose to stay with us? We need to make them kind of fit the underlying assets, kind of be in mind with what the industry's at, and likely provide some fee relief, if you will, to those investors that chose to stay with us. The other thing that was very important to us is that we split the holdings pari passu so that both the exiting investors and the continuing investors held proportionately the same amount of less liquid securities. So the first thing we did, as I said, is kind of identify what does the new fund look like, what is a reasonable amount of time for people to get all of their money back, and what constraints do we need to put around liquidity so that this doesn't happen again. We developed that plan. We then sent out a notice of what it looked like to the investors and let them make the decision on whether they wanted to stay with us or they wanted to leave. And that happened near the end of December when the plan went out. By the end of January, I believe, we had all of the responses. By April 1st is when it became effective. We needed some of that time to set up these new legal structures, as well as get the institutions we were doing business with comfortable with the plan, and get the accounts set up to handle it. Then on April 1st, we literally made massive transfers for kind of a proportionate amount of securities into a new master vehicle, which was the liquidating fund, and began to sell those positions down then on April 1. From the time we noticed investors of suspension until April, I would say that what we may have done differently than some is we did make a conscious decision to kind of maximize the portfolios for those investors that were choosing to stay with us. And by saying that, I guess what I'm saying is we didn't kind of, between October and April, start selling down the portfolios dramatically so as to create liquidity just for the exiting investors. We chose to do it on April 1st and then return capital to investors each subsequent month.
Okay, that makes sense.
So in the process, you know, the terms of the funds went from being monthly liquidity to quarterly liquidity, and it's really three of the main funds that were involved in this: the credit fund, the convertible fund, and our multi-strategy fund. Then in addition to moving to quarterly liquidity, we went to a 60-day notice on convert and credit, and a 45-day notice period on the multi-strategy fund. We implemented a 25% investor level gate, a 20% fail-safe kind of fund level gate. Investors were allowed to take redemptions above 25%, but if they chose to do that, there was a fee associated with it that would get paid back into the fund for providing that liquidity. 3% on the multi-strat and 4% on the credit and convert fund. The other thing then that we implemented was a rescission fee. So if an investor chose to put in a redemption during that notice period and then wanted to rescind, they were going to pay 50 basis points to rescind, and again, that would be paid back into the fund. Now, the one piece that I am leaving out is that the gate was tighter for 2009. It was only 5% per quarter for 2009. And then starting the first quarter of 2010, it went to the 25. So it was more constrained during 2009.
So Jonathan, if I heard
now,
you... Go ahead.
The last thing I was going to mention was the fee-related note. You know, the fees on the fund had been 1.5 and 20. If the investor chose to stay with us, they did have two options. They were able to immediately change their management fee to 1% for the life of that investment, or they could stay at 1.5% for 2009, then have it scaled down to 1% in 2010 and 50 basis points for the life of the investment. It's kind of a scaling down management fee.
I see. So if I heard you correctly, you're saying that the redemption requests you got in early November that corresponded to about 10% roughly of the overall assets was not the compelling factor for liquidating some of the portfolio. It was more the restrictions caused by your funding arrangements with your prime brokers. Is that correct?
That would be fair. One of the reports that we do internally, we call it our total equity report. Essentially, what it's meant to do is identify where all the assets of a particular fund are and what the excess is that's associated with that particular fund. Historically speaking, 20% excess is sufficient for most any environment. Coming into this, we were managing them at 20. As we were kind of positioning ourselves for November redemption, most of the funds were running around 35%. That's when we got the call that essentially, if all of these things were to double, it put a lot of them in our, you know, in our view, kind of in a danger zone in terms of how much excess liquidity was available to meet margin requirements. You know, many of the funds would have been down in the 7 to 12%, and that was so really, you know, that was driven by kind of movements on the street.
I see. Interesting. Were you at any point concerned about the viability of any of your prime brokers?
We had been pretty focused, I would say, on who we chose to have as counterparties. We did choose to lead Bear Stearns in 2006. We were comfortable. We were using five primes, so we were reasonably spread out in terms of the amount of counterparty risk we had with any one institution. I also was very aggressive in the terms that I was requiring in our documents with institutions that we were kind of starting businesses with or looking to do business with during 07 and 08.
When they started to become
and I think, you know, yes, I had concerns. I had concerns about Morgan Stanley. I had some concern about Goldman Sachs. Lehman, we were concerned about, and most of our relationships with Morgan Stanley and Lehman were ISDA relationships for total return swaps. And what I told my trading desk, because typically it was the calculation agent language that we got hung up on, that I wouldn't do business with anyone that wouldn't agree to it. The, solution or agreement with my desk that I made was that I allowed them to do some equities with both of those institutions on total return swap, because I felt it was pretty difficult to debate what the closing price of an equity was. The bigger risk was in a convertible or other OTC type position. But yes, we were very conscious and hopefully very strategic in who we chose to do business with.
Can you characterize the perception of other hedge funds with their relationships with, let's say, Bear Stearns or Lehman around those times?
I think fewer people were aware in 06 or had any concern in 06. I think as you moved into later 07 and early 08, and definitely after, obviously, Bear Stearns, that there was heightened concern. Many CFOs, I think, had conversations about who you were doing business with, how it was going, were you concerned? And obviously, before too long, and certainly after Bear Stearns, you had several inbound calls from investors who had become much more concerned about who you were doing business with.
I've heard that other than the big five investment banks, that at this time, Deutsche Bank and Credit Suisse were pretty aggressive in making calls, saying that they were more secure. Is this something you experienced?
I think many of the institutions did try to get out in front of it in presenting their case and how they had ring-fenced assets, structurally done things differently than other people. There definitely was a lot of people out trying to differentiate themselves. We were doing business with Deutsche Bank at the time. We were not with Credit Suisse. We had the majority of our business with BNP, which actually was through Bank of America, and BNP acquired the prime brokerage business. Dealing with the French credit folks like I have over the years, I figured if anyone was risk adverse, it was them. But in dealing with Deutsche Bank again over the years, some of the Swiss banks, and probably to a lesser extent, Deutsche Bank, tend to be a little bit more aggressive. And I think we were consciously aware of that. I think to a certain extent, you had a sense of, which institutions are too big to fail. Will the German government step up and not let Deutsche Bank fail? The Swiss government step up and not let CSFB fail?
Did you have any view at 07, early 08, before Bear and then obviously before Lehman, whether the U.S. government had any concerns about, take an extreme example, letting Goldman fail? Or did you have any concerns about any of the, besides Lehman and Bear, which I guess were the two weak sisters at the time, Merrill or Morgan Stanley or Goldman, were there, what was the word on the street then? And was the concept of too big to fail actually expressed by either you guys or by the other folks that you talked to?
I think the concept of too big to fail was pretty prevalent in 07. I think the big shakeup was Bear Stearns and what happened, and that's when there began to be some doubt of, are institutions too big to fail? And I do think that there was, a lulled sense of security when Bear, technically didn't fail. And I think that's partly why Lehman, I don't know if you caught people off guard, but I think there probably was a false sense of security that, governments won't let large financial institutions fail. So I honestly think that probably, from the time frame of, say, mid-07 until the Bear, people probably were more fearful of large institutions failing. And then there was a false sense of security when Bear didn't. And then there was a holy shit factor when Lehman did. Frankly.
Yeah.
That's when people really got scared.
Did you... say, for example, after Lehman went under, did you hear of any stories where prime brokers were refusing their clients access to cash and securities to move them around?
This is something that's gone on for a very long time. Most managers request cash movements from institutions they do business with, primarily through a fax. You say, here's my instructions, I would like you to move X dollars from your institution to this institution, and then it's duly authorized by those kind of authorized to request the transaction. What tends to happen in very stressful times is those faxes tend to get lost. I'm not sure that's just coincidental.
Wow.
We did experience that in 08. I've experienced it in my history before. I will guarantee you that there were stories, and they are valid, that if you made a request to move money from one of your institutions you were doing business with to another one, that faxes were lost, phone messages didn't get heard. They were very reluctant and very slow to send out that money. That was collateral for whatever lending they had against you, and they really didn't want to give it to the other one.
Did that cause any problems?
It didn't for us. Now, one of the things, again, and this kind of changed from an industry standpoint, The word unencumbered cash got bandied about a lot. And what a lot of funds started to do, kind of post-Bear Stearns, pre-Lehman, is sweep all available cash away from the institutions they were doing business with into another institution so that they had control of releasing those funds and could make sure that if they had a margin call at one institution, they weren't reliant on getting that money from the other institution they did business with to meet that margin call. I took a very proactive approach to that. We started pulling in not all of our cash, but substantial amounts of our excess and keeping them at what we were dealing with, Wells Fargo is who we do business with, so that I knew that if I went to my controller and said, I need you to send $10 million to XYZ broker, it was going to happen because it was under our control. Now, ironically enough, that posture, that stance, is probably something that weakened many of these institutions, because substantial amounts of cash collateral that had been kind of there at their disposal and known, all of a sudden was an unknown. Managers like ourselves were willing to pay higher expense ratios via financing to have certainty in being able to make payments on margin calls. Some of that continues today. It's not, for us as a firm, something that we believe in. And we leave substantially our cash with these institutions on access. Reduces our, obviously, kind of overall carrying costs of our funds and the financing associated, which ultimately enhances the returns for our investors at some level. The other thing, kind of going back to the committed facilities that evolved, was a lot of institutions like ourselves, or a lot of managers, I should say, had negotiated committed facilities, whether it be 60 days, 90 days, or in some extreme cases, 180. And in many ways, you were able to get that for no fee. It's just because you were large, you paid them a lot of money in financing, you had the negotiating leverage to do it. Along with those agreements, there was frequently NAV triggers or other defaults that would cause kind of that agreement to be negated. Certain institutions had some very fine print in their agreements that allowed them to wiggle out of some of them. Most of them were blown through because of performance-related triggers rather than kind of clever legal maneuvers. When things started to heal, some institutions came back offering facilities or amounts of capital they were willing to commit to, or financing they were willing to commit to at very exorbitant rates. Early on, it was, we could get you, say, $100 million or $200 million in balances, but it's going to cost you 250 basis points to guarantee that it's there for a year, whatever it is. And roll forward to where we are today, committed facilities really aren't available unless you're willing to pay for them. Now, the cost of having one has come down dramatically. My negotiations with institutions has been that, I would like to have 60 days, but I'm not willing to pay you a dime for it. At a minimum, I would like 30 days. I'm comfortable that, again, kind of with the change in liquidity terms of our funds, getting a 30-day, more or less, standstill from these institutions, that I won't be precluded from being able to deliver liquidity to my investors. Some managers have taken a more aggressive position in wanting kind of the insurance of knowing that they will have that financing available to them and are willing to pay for it. And, you know, on an annualized basis, I would say some managers are paying 1% to 1.5% in additional fees to guarantee access to those lending lines.
Okay.
But most of us were subsidized, probably unbeknownst to long short equity guys, but by long short equity.
Just from my understanding, so a typical prime broker is able to use that unencumbered cash to fund their organization. Is that correct?
It's just part of, you know, their overall capital of the bank. You know, it's cash on their balance sheet. One of the things that happens is most of these committed facility agreements are written with some sort of look back that says we will continue to finance you for 30 days, 60 days, whatever it is, at a level that we financed you over the previous 20 days. So to ensure that you are borrowing the maximum amount, you draw out the cash that's available to you to increase to the maximum amount borrowable so that if you trip this, you know you've locked in the maximum amount you can borrow for 60 days. It also, of course, keeps that cash away as collateral and leaves the flexibility more with the manager than the institution. The institution, of course, loves to, number one, have the collateral on their balance sheet, as well as kind of the cash associated. It just makes their overall balance sheets look better for tri-party repos or whatever kind of refinancing that's going on in the background or rehypothecation.
I'm glad you brought that up. So after the Lehman bankruptcy, did you hear of any stories of issues related to rehypothecation and commingling of assets through Lehman's?
You know, it seemed like a revelation to most people in the business that it actually went on. Again, I don't know that everyone read their entire prime brokerage document and understood what they signed up for. But part of being able to lend to a manager at a level that's compelling for us, you know, call it, you know, a 25 basis point haircut on your short rebate, and you know, whatever it is, 50 basis points you pay over Fed funds on the long side, 75, 90, whatever it is, part of that consideration in what that rate is the fact that they can make money rehypothecating your positions, either to a tri-party repo or by lending out your longs. I think that the major revelation was for long-short equity guys. Long short equity was, you know, used in tri-party repos to create diversified baskets to reduce the financing on the tri-party side, which reduced the cost to us as managers. When long short equity guys, and probably, you know, partially driven by some of the large U.S. pensions, said, "You are not allowed to rehypothecate my positions," and took that stance, it just kind of, you know, threw another whatever in the machine and ground things to a halt. All of a sudden, long-short equity couldn't be, or a substantial amount of the longs, weren't being rehypothecated, weren't allowed to go on the tri-party repo, increased the institution's financing, increased our costs, and... You know, I think, you know, some pension funds kind of saw it as, you know, this is what we should do as U.S. citizens. You know? But the fact of the matter is, for most managers, rehypothecating is a necessary evil in the overall generation of alpha. Long-short equity guys, there's probably more of them now that don't allow for some of the rehypothecation. And it does get into a lot, you know, probably above my pay grade, discussions around, you know, the legal custody of those rehypothecated assets, whose name they're in, and should the institution go bankrupt, where are we all in the pecking order of getting our money? You know, and that's vis-a-vis the Lehman issue.
So do you think we could see some of these effects in the securities lending and tri-party repo markets? Perhaps in sort of...
I'm not sure I understand. Do I think we could see some of these effects?
Right.
I don't understand the question, I don't think.
So under these changing conditions that would ostensibly shut down some of these markets, would you expect to see blips in securities lending or tri-party repo arrangements on an aggregate scale?
I think you saw kind of a landslide effect in late 08, where it you know essentially vanished almost. The Fortises and some of these other people that were very prevalent in tri-party basically said, no go, I'm done, I'm not doing it. Two, you know, it is a viable, necessary evil of this industry. There are willing people to do it now. You know, you have to remember that competition shrank dramatically. The amount of assets that are being managed by alternatives or hedge funds has gone down dramatically. The amount of leverage that's being provided out there has gone down dramatically. So the amount of tri-party repo kind of necessary to support the current managers has probably come down dramatically. So I think there was an initial shock to the system by all the forced deleveraging, but it seems to have stabilized, I would say pretty dramatically. It's incredibly more stable. You know, in the last 6 months, for sure, and probably even a little further 9 months back, you know, institutions that said, you know, not only do we want, you know, we don't want any more of your convertibles, we won't take any more, to getting inbound calls saying, we've got capacity, do you have any you want to put with us? So it's definitely kind of, the tone has changed.
Can you talk a little about how a firm, a hedge fund, goes about liquidating assets that it believes to be at temporarily depressed prices?
Really difficult question to answer. A hedge fund, I think, ideally the hedge fund doesn't sell any of the assets that are temporarily depressed. And, you know, again, it gets into the whole asset liability mismatching and all that fun stuff. If it's contextually talk about, you know, how did people react in late 08 to massive deleveraging, you know, significant increases in collateral requirements and demands by investors for their money? Because that was, you know, the most extreme situation that I have ever seen in my lifetime, and hopefully the most extreme I ever do see. And I think different people handled it differently. We are two things. One, very U.S.-centric in the types of instruments we hold, and we are also probably skewed to a higher concentration of convertibles. So some of what I say, you know, have to be taken under that kind of context. The convertible market essentially evaporated in November, December of 2008. And, you know, bids that were shown in the market really didn't exist because if you tried to hit it, no one would stand behind it. So something that in any normal environment was liquid became illiquid. Now, I can tell you that we had a managed account that came to us. We, as I said, we chose to suspend. We felt it was the right thing to do. This managed account, by mandate of their underlying investors, said, we have to sell. We said, we won't do that. They said, we're going to fire you as the manager and we're going to hire another party. We said, fine. During that process, they hired kind of a third-party liquidator that came in and aggressively sold their book at insane levels and did exit it. Now, it's nothing we would have done for our investors. You know, they did it as things began to improve, but they flushed it very, very quickly. Money started, you know, in the convertibles, traditional long-only convertible managers came back into that space in late November and began to buy because they become so attractive. And the dynamics of the holders of convertibles, which had been extremely overweight hedge funds, you know, call it 80-90%, I would argue, of the U.S. convertible market was owned by hedge funds, which we were basically selling back and forth based on, you know, how each of us determined the option value embedded in the convertible, to an asset class that was being flushed down the toilet and got so extreme that traditional and I would argue long-short equity managers were buying it in place of equities. Long-only convertible managers began to buy it. Institutions that recognized it as a very attractive asset class at those levels chose, again, in my opinion, to give their money to long-only mutual convertible funds as opposed to hedge funds, because they offered daily liquidity and were, you know, 40 Act regulated. And so it really what happened is kind of the underlying holders of convertibles shifted dramatically from November through, you know, probably first quarter, even second quarter. And today even remains, I think, much more owned by long-only traditional managers than hedge funds than it has been for many years. So some guys chose to sell to those traditional managers. We chose to maintain what we felt was leverage that we could get through the crisis and then, as I said, kind of split, and we chose to sell down positions aggressively but orderly. So we sold to a point where when we felt we were becoming the market, we quit selling.
Okay, that makes sense.
And that was kind of a daily, you know, quite frankly, a daily analysis.
Okay. Thanks for that explanation. So I want to shift just a little and talk more about specific topics. Earlier you mentioned you had a fund that took specific exposure to single name RMBS. I wanted to ask you a little more about that and perhaps whether you guys played in the CDO space as well, what kind of exposures you sought, what kind of tranches you you looked for.
We didn't play in the CDO market. We were in single name mortgage pools. We screened those pools for specific characteristics. We looked for pools that had a high percentage of liar loans, had a high geographic concentration in Florida and Nevada specifically, and that's kind of how we built our portfolio.
And this was, because you said earlier that you're shorting subprime, so the stuff that you look for that was concentrated in California, Florida, Arizona, Florida, and had the higher percentage of liar loans, is that to go short or to go long?
Short.
Okay.
We bought protection in single name pools.
In the form of CDS, is that right?
Yep, correct.
Okay.
We didn't play the index that was created. I think it was the CDX index, if I recall correctly.
Okay. Did you guys, because I know Market launched the ABX.HE in January of 2006, and I remember there was a big fanfare. Did you guys?
ABX. That's the one. We did not play in the ABX. We played in single name pools.
Okay.
Can you talk a little about the CDS market and your participation in it and whether that may have changed throughout the crisis? For example, we've heard stories that it became very hard to enter the CDS market at various times.
It definitely came hard to enter it. I think if you know, we started to build our positions back in 2006 in our main funds, and really had what we considered the full position on, and I don't remember what it was notionally, I'd have to look. I want to say we maybe had $300 million notionally in our main funds by October, November of 2006. And so it was really a matter of staying in that position, paying negative carry, and waiting for what we thought was the eventual outcome. Based on our conviction in that trade, we felt that the opportunity was unique enough that we could raise assets to do that specific investment. And that's what led us to form the Special Opportunities Fund line and launch the very first one, which was Special Opportunities A, with kind of an explicit mandate to do subprime. We didn't raise a lot of money. We only raised, I think, $50 million. We tried to launch it in January of 07 and ended up having the institution that we were hoping to open the fund with basically back down and not want to do it, and eventually got the documentation done necessary to open the account in time to launch the fund on April 1st. We got a window of opportunity where the names that we trafficked in actually were the spreads had come in, and it was briefly, kind of, it was a one-shot deal. You got a chance to enter it again, enter that market. So we fully invested that fund during April. We weren't able to invest it at the level that we had discussed with the investors in terms of the amount of leverage and exposure that we intended. So we actually chose to return part of the capital to investors to hit what we felt was kind of the target leverage ratio. And we did that, I think it was in May or June. We returned part of the capital back to the investors. And then remained fully invested in those positions kind of through the crisis and obviously participated. The challenges associated, and I think it's, you know, the evolution of the CDS market, if you're talking even single-name corporates, when that market began to develop, I remember having a CFO meeting out in Midtown Manhattan with a bunch of guys talking about that market and talking about kind of the accounting administration at the institutions for those investments was, you know, at best subpar. There were, you know, piles of contracts on some of these kind of associates' desks at these institutions that weren't fully executed. And that was, you know, probably mid-05, and really kind of single name CDS related to corporations. Many systems evolved from 05 to 07 that, you know, T0 is one that we used, but there were many like it that basically provided for kind of immediate affirmation of the trade on the day of the trade. Sometimes the booking of the trade might take another day or two, but, you know, from a accounting standpoint, the systems, you know, evolved quickly and people did catch up, and things were working. The piece that didn't make sense was, the kind of pricing that my desk would do on these instruments based on spreads. And what we would kind of use to estimate our performance made absolutely no sense when we got the sheet from the broker at the end of the month. The levels the brokers would show for pricing were not levels at which any of them were willing to trade at. being in kind of the environment that we come to, which is, you know, some concern around third-party valuation. You know, there really wasn't a third party out there pricing these, none that anyone would use or rely on. Market Partners was beginning to evolve, but was not by any means kind of a go-to. You were somewhat captive to pricing your book at what the institutions had on their monthly statement. And that's what we found ourselves doing, because that was the price we could point to and say, here's how we got it, or where we got it from, and what I'm contractually bound to. It really wasn't, you know, until, oh gosh, I don't know if it was late 07, early 08, when you started to see some of the pricing change. And then, of course, you know, the gig was up on Bear Stearns CDS when they basically teetered on the brink of failure. The price had to be something near par for insurance on their bond.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I think the story that you hear of guys showing it to their bosses and getting paid bonuses based on what it said probably has some credence. And then, you know, the world began to implode at the end of 08, and the marks became more realistic.
There have been some prominent figures that have blamed the demise of Bear Stearns and Lehman on short sellers. Do you have an opinion on this, or what's your perspective?
You know, I don't have an opinion on that. It's one of those chicken and the egg things. You know, Bear Stearns was a very large institution, and to get a group of people with the financial backing to, you know, drive a valuation of a company of that size, it seems really difficult, but I think you could get agreement in the financial community prior to the demise of Bear Stearns that they were in a lot of trouble. So you could imagine a lot of people wanting to be short Bear Stearns. So, you know, I've read some of the accounts of that. You know, I wouldn't completely discredit it. Do I think they're plausible? They're plausible. Can you prove it? Probably not.
And that's a conundrum we're in.
Yeah.
There's also a story that I'm not that familiar with, just hoping you could help us out. There's some accounts of the Quant Fund blow up in the first week of August 2007. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Can you tell us a little about that?
I can give you some anecdotal information. We do run, at the time we were actually running two funds that are long short equity based. Quantitative funds, each was a little different in how they approached the space. We've never run, at least, again, in our view, what I would consider leveraged long-short funds. We typically run a dollar long, a dollar short for a dollar of equity. You know, maybe a slight skew, like a $1.10, you know, long versus a dollar, but not that we're running 3 times, 4 times, 5 times leverage, which I know some folks were at the time. We saw dislocations, and we run multi-factor models. We really use them as screening tools to help us make decisions on where we want to invest rather than kind of setting an order right to the floor. But we saw, you know, Six Sigma standard deviation events that we'd never seen happen 2 or 3 days in a row. At the extreme, you know, we saw, I think, one of our funds down 10% in a day and another fund down 16. Again, we were unlevered for funds that, you know, it was easily imaginable that stories of some quant funds being down 30% was, again, plausible. If they're running 2 to 3 times leverage, it's likely. A lot of guys, I mean, there's plenty of mathematically sophisticated guys in this business. You know, I think most managers of our size have the quant PhD on staff at a minimum, whether they have them trading or not, developing models as screening tools and trying to identify unusual dislocations that mathematically don't make sense. But you know, if and we are not a shop that believes in VAR, and there's many investors that demand a risk metric like VAR as a means of understanding their risk, and I think a lot of managers have provided that in the past, as have third-party risk aggregators, and a lot of people employed a chief risk officer that would use a similar tool. I think if you are in a world that that is a measure of risk and it's measured in the same way, that anyone that's trying to manage away from that risk is, they're all managing themselves to a different risk, and it's correlated. And that's kind of what, you know, I fear happened, you know, during that crisis, is that even though we all, or many managers, I'll say, managed away from a certain identifiable risk, they were all managing to another one that, yeah, they all didn't realize they were kind of set up the same way and highly correlated. Yes, I heard of, you know, a very large, well-known institution that, you know, supposedly was exiting heavily, that, you know, might have caused, you know, some of the impetus, if you will, for kind of that brief shock, 2-3 days. And again, I think guys were just much more correlated than they knew.
I'd also heard that there may have been a couple funds that had subprime exposures and then looked to liquidate their more sellable assets, and then that might have been a triggering event. Is that does that sound feasible?
During, and that would have been August. If you were on the wrong side of that trade, it is feasible. Meaning if you sold protection rather than bought protection, because there was a coming shock to the system. I think September, October, if I recall, there was a major reset coming up on a lot of mortgages. And I think that reset was likely to uncover a lot of defaults or inability to refinance, which would force a default. So again, I think that's probably plausible. But I would think more likely from people on the other side of that trade.
Do you think there could have been any knock-on effects to, say, the securities lending market from that episode?
We didn't. I don't recall any knock-on effects to securities lending at that time. At least in traditional markets, I don't consider kind of the CDS market anything related to the kind of stock lending market.
Well, more like the long short funds unwinding.
If anything, it typically, you know, I would expect to be providing relief. Unless you're getting into a short squeeze situation, then yeah. not something we saw or experienced. Now we're in the small micro cap space. So if they were in larger caps, mid caps, I just can't speak to it or provide color on it because we weren't exposed to it.
I see. More generally, can you think of any government actions that were particularly helpful or damaging throughout the crisis?
Vis-a-vis the short prohibition. If you speak to any guy in the hedge fund industry and any kind of free market economist, I think they'll tell you it's the worst thing you can do. What I would tell you is, you know, when we had conversations with investors, kind of when I had conversations in late 07 and 08 before the crisis, and they asked, you know, the proverbial question, you know, what causes you to not be able to sleep at night? The one risk that I always, you know, brought to the forefront was the risk that I'm most concerned about is governmental intervention, because it's something we can't control and it completely changes, you know, the dynamics and the outcome of trades. I didn't expect kind of short sale prohibition. I was fearful of mortgage bailouts and how it may affect our subprime positions. I think, you know, there was a populist kind of movement that Wall Street was, you know, fucking up Main Street, and, you know, we need to take care of these, you know, rich bastards that are in their private planes and their Porsches.
It's like the fat cat bankers.
I mean, you definitely didn't feel like there was any love lost for Wall Street or hedge funds. You know, my personal humble opinion is I don't know that hedge funds as an asset class really were to blame, or the right groups to be pointing the finger at, or at least not in a broad way, for the crisis that evolved. Internally, I would tell you the one that probably, you know, scared us the most was the short selling, and the prohibition, if you will, prohibition on the ability to short sell in financial names, because if we're dealing in a hedge position and we hold the convertible note, puts a significant piece of that particular trade out of our control.
Probably a little more non-standard question. I was just curious if you had any anecdotes that were particularly enlightening from your own personal experience. For example, or to put us in your shoes navigating this crisis, I should say. For example, I've heard a couple of people talk about going on vacation, and of course plans change and they spend their entire week at the beach on the cell phone calming down investors and such things. Just curious if you had anything interesting like that.
Oh, absolutely. I was supposed to be going to Vancouver and riding a train with my wife to Whistler for our anniversary on October 21st. To telling her, we're not going there, honey, and I'm not sure what I'm going to be doing, but I'm going to be very busy for a while. It definitely turned the world upside down for, I think, anyone in a position similar to mine. I found myself doing, and I think probably at the core of surviving this, I think it was you need to be transparent, you need to be honest, and that's both with the institutions you're dealing with as well as your underlying investors, and I tried to be in front of all of them as often as possible. I was in New York every other weekend. I was sitting at a bar every Sunday night that had Wi-Fi, logging in, watching the markets to see what was going to break in the Asian markets first, because it usually was an indicator. And there were, you know, a lot of news releases, right, coming from the Fed or whoever, ahead of those markets opening that obviously were going to affect us the next day. They know me well at the bar.
Were there any conversations you had where you look back and think of that conversation and you say, wow, that's how messed up things were. I can't believe that we had to be doing this.
I can't think of a conversation like that. There were, you know, conversations with investors, some of them were surprising conversations in terms of what their expectations were, what was realistic in the current environment. There definitely was a sense of panic. I was, as I said, in New York meeting, and there's some things, I'll give you an example of something that, yes, I don't forget. So I mentioned to you about margining and changes in margining and a couple institutions that were kind of ahead of the game because they were beta testing a new margining system. One of the other institutions I was doing business with, basically was trying to react as quickly as everyone else was. They were being acquired by another institution, acquiring another institution or part of an institution. Their new margining system for me was, here's your positions in an Excel spreadsheet. Look at the formulas, look how it changed, this is what we need. What happened was they took, one, they didn't have the systems to handle it. Two, they had credit officers that understood corporate bonds but didn't understand convertibles, and were giving kind of zero recognition for the hedge. But that was something where I could not believe, for the size of the institution that I was dealing with, that I was getting an email with an Excel spreadsheet as my margin report.
Yeah.
That I'll never forget.
Huh. I can imagine how that would how much confidence that would give you in their processes.
Exactly.
I guess just to wrap things up, can you give us just a synopsis of what you think of when you think of the financial crisis? How you explain it?
A synopsis of the financial crisis. Excess that leads to chaos. Synopsis. Excess leverage, aggressive financing, the ensuing chaos, unprecedented demands for liquidity.
Okay. That's about all the questions.
That's it for me.
Go ahead.
No, I said that's it for me. I mean, that's
okay.
About the quickest I can sum it up. So I hope it was helpful.
Absolutely. We can't tell you how much we appreciate your time and doing this. I think this is going to be something that we're all going to be able to learn from for a long period of time. And getting people who were down on the street in the trenches while this was going on is in a very important perspective and tremendously valuable. And I know that there are several other things you could be doing other than talking to us. So just wanted to thank you again on behalf of the commission.
Absolutely. I was glad to help.
All right.
Have a good day, guys.
Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thanks a lot.
Yep.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.